Session number 9005, Jeremy Black, Reel 4.
Around the ship were like flies, while dockyard workmen crawled everywhere, frantically aware that if they didn't finish, they'd find themselves voyaging to South America in a battle. The only strange note, Bill Weldon, who's our present vicar, who laboured there, and most of the rest of us, is the reference to coal, because that... it's so badly written, so I can't read it. That came from the first time around. It implies that the Black Gang, those engineers, have made some progress since 1914, but about the pussers, I'm a little less sure. It took them 3 days to store last time, and 30 years ago it took 3 days again. So that was one for Dan Shawland Vaugh, really. Took him between the eyes in the middle of dinner. Jellicoe protested at the loss of the Invincible and Inflexible to his grand fleet and the weakening of that fleet in the face of the Germans. This time we heard many commentators asking similar sorts of questions about the weakening of NATO in the northeastern Atlantic in the light of the task force moving south. In 1914, battle cruisers Invincible and Inflexible were untried. The long-range gunnery was a new concept. And this time, of course, it was this year, Invincible and the Sea Harrier were both untried. I've lost a bit about the number of days. It took the same number of days to get down there. There's some interesting little parallels, really. Rather badly written, then. Now, this whole business of design of warships is endlessly fascinating, because there is no right answer. And frequently you get this strong opinion. I, for instance, masterminded the island class, the fishery protection class that we now have. And whilst that was being considered in committee, I had the whole world against me. Every time I picked up the newspaper, there'd be some letter saying we needed 24 knots and these sort of fishing boat designs we were going for were no use, and so on. And I went to the House of Commons to talk to people. I went to sundry firms. Desmond Wetton was forever attacking me. And with the exception of Desmond Wetton, if I dug into those letters in the newspapers, there was always some professional interest. They were always, even if it was an MP, they were retained by some shipbuilder or something or something. And in the event, in the outturn, they've proved a very satisfactory class for the job which they do. And we're very pleased with them, really. So, this debate goes on, and there will always be people with different points of view. I don't think that you'll never get a total agreement as to what you should have in a class. And there will always be this opportunity subsequently to say, well, I said we should have helicopters with a hangar or helicopters without a hangar or whatever it is. But I think you've got to see it as a composite and see what you'd have foregone if you put something else in.
It's like the aluminium top weight, isn't it?
Hmm. Yes, of course, that is something which we don't actually use now. I mean, we had it in the 21s uniquely, but of course the 21s weren't designed by the Navy. They were designed by Vosper Thornycroft. But we've taken out a lot of it. The big disaster with aluminium topsides was an American destroyer, the Belknap, which collided with an aircraft carrier, fractured the fuel main, the aircraft fuel main, which then poured fuel onto the fire as the ship was stuck underneath the flight deck. And the whole of the aluminium superstructure caught fire. That was a major disaster. And we had a nasty one in one of the 21s in Singapore. I can't remember which one now. But on the whole, we've actually changed quite a lot. They used to have aluminium ladders in the engine room, and if they got a big fire in there, people couldn't get out because the ladders caught fire. So they were changed. But why people have gone for it is that the ship of 1914 had ammunition low down in the magazines, heavy engines. I think they were the two main ingredients. Well, now the machinery is much lighter, much smaller, and a lot of the munitions are carried on the upper deck. So we're now fighting always to reduce top weight. That leads to it.
And coal was the other thing.
Yes, and coal, indeed. So we're having difficulty, really, today. I don't know whether you've kept to your track, but we talked a bit about sort of Dartmouth, and then we've...
Yes, it doesn't matter. This is how things tend to go, actually.
We've left out the sort of middle chunk.
Yes. It might be nice to... how are you off for time? When must you be away by, fairly?
I should have thought I mustn't... say another three quarters of an hour or something like that. Quarter past six,
super.
Sorry.
How are we getting on there? What I'll do, I'll end up...
Was he a full admiral?
No, I don't think he was.
I was going to say, because it reads strangely that he goes...
The latter part of his career, you see, I'm not quite clear what rank
it would imply... that he was an admiral, as opposed to a rear admiral, say.
He only served as a rear admiral. He never served higher than that.
I was going to say, because he then became a major general, which equates to a rear admiral. So one imagines...
And then
it's just unfortunately written.
After he retired, they gave him the...
Oh, do you?
He did get promoted on the retired list.
Did he?
I think primarily for service for aviation.
Yeah.
Anyway, after subs,
of course. Yes, I then went to the Vanguard. This was in 53.
Must be just about the last commission, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes, it was. This was actually the January 54. I joined as the sub lieutenant in charge of the gunroom. Which is rather nice historically, the last battleship. I had a gunroom of 30 midshipmen. And a jolly nice job, and very nice position in the ship, really. I largely, in many respects, equated to a head of department, although then a sub-lieutenant. And it's a very privileged position, unique position in the ship. And we were also the flagship of the Home Fleet at the time. So that was a very nice job.
Was this joined the South Africa?
No,
long after.
Long after that, yes. That was 48. Mm-hmm. No, we didn't do... as I say, we flew the flag of the Commander-in-Chief, and we were around the Gibraltar, that sort of thing, rather like they're doing now, the spring exercises down there. Combined Mediterranean and Home Fleets met in Gibraltar, and I recall, you know, a dozen or 15 admirals on the quarterdeck at a dinner one evening, because there was Mountbatten was Commander-in-Chief of the Mediterranean, and he had his Chief of Staff and his Cruiser Admiral and Destroyer Admiral and what have you, and Home Fleet likewise had CS1 or whoever they were, a lot of different admirals, all of them then afloat. In the Vanguard itself, we had the commander-in-chief, the chief of staff, the captain of the fleet happened to be an admiral at that time, he'd just been promoted. So we had three resident. It was a different scene, really. 8 or 9 captains in the wardroom.
What did you see your role as being as the sub of the gun room?
I really presided over the life of the midshipmen. There was the snotty's nurse, who was the gunnery officer, who organised their training. And I more or less saw that they did their training. I was rather like a prefect. And I was the president of the gunroom mess, and therefore I was responsible for all the accounts and that they behaved reasonably well. All aspects of the administration of the gunroom. At the same time, of course, I was getting my watchkeeping certificate, so I was doing a lot of watchkeeping, both in harbour and at sea. So I combined those two duties.
Of all the roles that were played by people in the late Victorian Edwardian Navy, the bully of the gunroom sub is one of the classic pictures.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that probably disappeared in 1914 or after 1918.
Yes. I still thrashed people from time to time. Not very often. I suspect maybe 2 or 3 times when I was in the job. But beating was still available as a form of punishment for midshipmen.
By you?
By me.
Yeah. Which, of course, that didn't differ all that much from contemporary schools where...
Come from Dartmouth where I'd done the same thing. Because I was a house cadet captain at Dartmouth, which, head of house, which was the same thing, really. And this was recognised. It became a little... It was anachronistic in some ways. I recall when I was a midshipman myself, the sub-lieutenant beating one of the midshipmen who, in the event, I think, was older than he was, you know, because he was an Australian or something or other, by some quirk of the system. And then that all seemed rather futile. I don't think I applauded it, really, for midshipmen. I think they were a bit too mature for that sort of punishment myself. But anyway, there it was, and from time to time it happened. It was an interesting job, really. You know, you had 30 rather exuberant young men and trying to encourage them along and read their journals and get them to do their stuff. It was quite a big task.
You were responsible to the Sunday's nurse, Will?
Yes. I was for the training side, really to the commander for the disciplinary side. As I say, the Snotty's nurse lives in my village. In fact, the reason why I came to live there was because he found me a house. It was great times, really. Some excellent officers. So that
were you promoted
was,
to lieutenant while you were in the Vanguard?
Trying to remember. I got my watchkeeping ticket there, but answer, not quite. I went on from there to Hythe by Southampton in the New Forest, where we were collecting new minesweepers, inshore and coastal minesweepers, from the builders' yards, putting them through a set of trials, and setting up minesweeping squadrons in Harwich or where have you, or giving them to the French or what, or sometimes laying them up.
That's quite a lot of people never actually thought there was a tool
to do it. Right, not for a long time. So I did that, and I started by being, as a sub-lieutenant, being first lieutenant of one, and then I think I did that for one, and then I commanded the next one, by which time I was a lieutenant. So that was really my first taste of command, which was good stuff. And I went from that to the Comus in the Far East as the gunnery officer, destroyer gunnery officer, as they were called, sort of half-trained, really.
You hadn't done any course of whaling or anything, had you, beyond the normal?
Well, I did 6 weeks, a 6 weeks course, just really to learn the patter of the orders. And I went out as a gunnery officer to a strange man called Josef Czeslaw Bartoszyk, who was a Pole and had served in the Polish Navy all the war and then transferred to the RN after the war. And he was a martinet of a major order and led us the most awful life, terrible life. And I was his gunnery officer for 2 years in the Far East.
He was able to do that, was he?
There were about three of them, I think. He became an admiral in the end. A rare admiral. And he's still about now in London. But God, he really was an unpleasant man to serve. He was he ran quite a good ship, but he was so unpleasant while he did it to officers. I think not the rating so much, but the officers. He was particularly evil, really. So I did that till 57. I came back from that and qualified as a gunnery officer, which then took
four courses,
which took 20 months. In two halves, I did the first bit, maybe 15 months, and then I left. I left there and went as the. I went. Temporarily, I think it was, as the gunner of the Diamond, just for a short time. Wait a minute, am I talking sense or not? Yes, I think that's right. I went as gunner of the Diamond for a short time. And then I went as...
That's a daring class.
Daring class, yeah. And I was on the staff of what was then called Captain in Charge Portland. It's now Flag Officer Sea Training, for a month or two. And then I taught sub-lieutenants. It was normal for one or two people to be selected from a finishing long course to teach the sub-lieutenants going through. And I did that as my first proper job, post-long course. And then I went as the second gunner officer of the Gambia. That was the time I got married. And so I must have been 25 by this time. We then went off to the Far East and Indonesian and round and about, and on our way back, really, on the start of the journey back, I went in a hospital in Singapore and had a sinus operation, and by the time I'd finished that, the ship was in South Africa and it was impossible really to get back, so I flew straight back to England and threw away the rest of that commission. And then after a short pause, I suppose I went and did the other half of my gunnery course, that's right. So I went back and did the aviation part, because in those days we did the aviation bit at the end. The gunnery officer was in those days responsible for air weapons, and part of it was to learn to know what to select. So we studied the use of bombs and rockets and these things. And we also flew quite a lot, went up to Lossiemouth, and flew for about 6 weeks, side seat, and delivered all these different weapons. So I did that. And actually, now I'm getting better in place. It was after that second go that I then did this time as Henry Austin of the Diamond, I think, for a little while. And then I went as the captain of a minesweeper in Singapore. And
you were 2 and a half by then, were you?
No, I was still a lieutenant. And that was a very interesting job. We had a minesweeping squadron in Singapore, which we did quite a lot of minesweeping, more practice minesweeping, but we also chased pirates around Borneo. And I did 18 months of that, and a lot of independent command business. You go off with two minesweepers and a tanker, and for 3 or 4 weeks you'd hunt down pirates. And there was a lot of piracy at that time on the east coast of Borneo, to the extent that people tended not to sleep in their houses at night but to go off into the jungle, lest their village was set upon by chaps in things called dapangs, which were dug-out canoes with about 4 huge outboards across the stern. And they ripped along. They were descendants of the old Suluk pirates in the Sulu Sea. And so they were a part of the team we used to fight against. And the other lot were chaps smuggling copra out of Sukarno's Indonesia. I don't know if you can picture in your mind's eye the Suluk Sea, but it has Borneo to the west, which at that time was British North Borneo and just Indonesia, the bottom, Dutch Borneo as it had been. So that was bounds it on the western side. On the eastern side, northeastern is the Philippines, and southeastern is Celebes. And this little sea is only 100 miles across. And so you had people moving in all directions. All of them were illegal for one reason or another. And these copra smugglers smuggled their way out of Celebes, where Sukarno wasn't paying decent prices for copra, and across into Tawau in British North Borneo. And the British, therefore, protected that trade because it was to their advantage. But the Suluk pirates, who had lived in islands in the middle, or just to the north of the middle, they set upon these guys and were absolutely ruthless. I mean, they would shoot the whole lot without turning a hair. And we really went out largely to protect that trade. So that was jolly interesting, and gave one a taste of independent command, which was very healthy. And I did that for 2 years, and right at the end came the terrorist attempt to take over Brunei. And I sailed prior to the thing blowing up. It was in the wind, and 2 of us were sailed, and I went as the senior officer, and we got across there within hours of the thing blowing up. And we arrived in the town of Brunei. I don't know if you know it, but it's partly a town on land and partly a town on stilts in the water up the Brunei River. And we helped to get 4-2 Commando in there from Labuan. They flew across to Labuan, just north of Brunei, and some of the men flew into Brunei, and others came across with our 2 minesweepers and so on. And when we got there at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, the Marine Colonel, the CO of 4-2 Commando, told me there were hostages in a town called Limbang, which was perhaps 6 hours steaming away up the rivers, and that we were going to try and get them out. So we commandeered a couple of Z-lighters. They looked like landing craft, but with no sides, and built some sides on them. And at midnight, they sailed for Limbang with a company of Royal Marines, Lima Company of 4-2 Commando, commanded by Major Jeremy Moore. And the next morning, there was a bloody great battle, and we lost 5 Marines. We got out the 5 hostages, and Major Jeremy Moore got an MC. And last December, I went to the 20th anniversary where General Jeremy Moore inspected the commando, and two of the hostages came over from Australia. So that was rather fun. But that was an exciting little battle. And then we went on from there. I think I was there for about 2 weeks, during which time we made two more raids with them. By this time the commandos had moved on, and we had 2nd 6th Gurkhas, I think, and with them we made another landing, and also we made an attack on this Kampong Aya, it was called, this village on stilts, try and rout out terrorists from that. I don't think actually we found any in that, but it was rather an exciting operation, because just by this time we did that raid using about 30 little open boats with two Gurkhas and a sailor, and we blew the whistle at 5 a.m. or something, and all the engines were started, they're all outboards, because we knew we'd give it all away, see, as soon as we started the outboards. So they were all lined up, and off they roared and put their Gurkhas into this place. So that was a very exciting time, because I was the senior naval officer afloat, so I was doing it all with these different military organizations. It ended in a funny way. I got back to Singapore just before Christmas, and then I left the ship in not long after that, in February, came back to England, and I was summoned back to Singapore to be court-martialed for a number of irregularities that had occurred in this minesweeper. And halfway through the court-martial, my award of the MBE came through. And so I was really court-martialed and decorated for the same 2 weeks, which is rather a strange quirk. Don't know how often people have had both. And then I subsequently got a rather glamorous decoration from the Sultan of Brunei. But, as I say, I was then...
What were the problems with the, accounting or stores? Or?
That sort of thing, yeah. There were 17 charges of different kinds. But my first lieutenant, for instance, had falsified some victualling accounts, and the chief bosun's mate, who was a leading sailor, had sold a lot of the minesweeping equipment in Kuching. We hadn't noticed, or I hadn't noticed it. There were, you know, irregularities of that nature. And I felt a bit lonely at this time, being court-martialed, so I hunted around, and I got as my defending counsel a young captain in Singapore called Leach, who subsequently went on to great fame. And my prosecuting counsel was a commander, in his first job, called Staveley, who's now the commander-in-chief of the fleet. So I've gone on with these two ever since. I think it's really come out to my advantage in the end. But certainly it was a shoulder-broadening experience.
Were you reprimanded for it?
Yeah.
But just reprimanded?
Mm. Yes, I reckon.
Because presumably the loss of the equipment really was a major problem with it.
No. No, I think the... several of the charges I pleaded guilty to. I mean, a lot of the charges were very footling. It stemmed from the fact that we came back from Brunei after that operation, and we brought with us one of these little outboard dugouts, which presumably belonged to somebody. But, we had taken them all over, some 30-odd, as I say. And there were many rivers, as I'd encountered quite soon after my next trip to Borneo after that operation. So that if you lowered the boat in the water with the engine full ahead, it still wouldn't, it wouldn't stay there. Because the river was roaring by. And so this little outboard craft seemed to be a good idea, for allowing us to operate.